Welcome to CSS. We're glad you're here. It's kind of a rainy and gray day, so it must feel very typical for you guys.
Right
at home in the Netherlands, huh? We've picked a typical day for you. Welcome. We're delighted you're here. Thank you all for coming. This is we still have a bunch of people caught upstairs getting their little yellow stickers, so they'll be down joining us, so please don't worry as people kind of climb over you to get a seat. We're delighted to welcome Jeroen here today. This is an iconic event. You know, I think you think back in the history of business. I'm certainly no historian of business, but there are a number of companies that have established really kind of iconic qualities. You think of Toyota and its manufacturing methods, or you think of General Electric and its leadership development programs. But you would have to say that certainly for Shell and the way it's developed this scenario planning, it has become an iconic quality, you know, of business leadership. What typically makes these things iconic is that everybody imitates them and nobody does as well, you know, doing them. And I sit on a number of corporate boards, and everybody's tries to do things like this, but not with the depth and the sophistication that Shell has pioneered here. And it's really quite impressive. We've had a chance to be modest partners to this effort over the years. Shell has been working with us through the years to talk to, you know, our regional experts and our energy people to try to get our take on things. And of course, they still integrate it and synthesize it in their own way. And it's really quite valuable and quite important to have as an intellectual contribution. So we're delighted they're here. We're delighted that you are all here. Let me just say that I don't anticipate it's going to be hard, but I do encourage you all to be active inquisitors in this session. The quality of any one of these presentations is directly proportional to the engagement of the audience, and we do expect a lively and spirited discussion. So, Jeroen, we welcome you. I'm not going to spend any time introducing you because everybody has that in front of them. But I do want to say thank you. Welcome. We're delighted you're here. And let's turn it to you for the real show. Thank you for coming.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I realize that I got an invitation only for Fool's Day to speak here. How are we going to do it? And that's based on our experience last night in New York as well. We have 1 hour, but we shortened our presentation a lot because I think the gist of the scenarios, we can explain that quite briefly together with Jeremy, and we have our chief economist, as we call him, Stephen Fries, here as well. And then we have ample time for questions. And last night at least, and I hope that you like to see this competitive American nature, that at least you have the same amount and quality of questions as we had last night in New York. Well, I would like to recall you, why do we make scenarios in Shell? We make scenarios in Shell not for public relations, but to figure out what is the best strategy for the firm. So that's the objective. And the basic scenario philosophy is very simple. And the very short story about it is, if you are an entrepreneur and it is bad weather, like today, you can decide you sell umbrellas. But then if it turns to be nice, yeah, then you have made the wrong choice. Or you sell ice creams and it turns to be the rain. Does it work like that? So what we try to find in Shell, we call that the chocolate bars. Because whether it is good weather or a bad weather, all people in the world keep eating chocolate bars, Mars bars. That's the idea. So we make those energy scenarios, and then we start to figure out what are the chocolate bars. Of course, we emphasize our presentation, what are the scenarios. But if you have questions, is what kind of conclusions for the firm, yeah, we will not tell everything that we know, but we can give you certain indications about that. Jeremy will talk about the scenarios itself. I think we have first to take stock what is the existing wisdom. And existing wisdom are three hard truths. There's a little wink to Mr. Al Gore. And the first hard truth is that energy demand in the world will double between now and the year 2050. And then we take into account that energy conservation goes much faster than in the past. So energy demand, total energy demand, will double between now and 2050. Why is that? We go from 6 to 9 billion people. You see that on the left hand. But as important as well, all people like to have electricity, and they at least like to drive what we call now a Tata. And that, of course, that drives that energy demand. That is the first hard truth. The second hard truth is that the supply of existing oil and gas, as you have experienced it, and we call that by and large easy oil and easy gas, will not be sufficient for all this demand that we expect. So we need a lot either unconventional resources on a huge scale, or renewables on a huge scale, or something else happened, and that has then to do with a lot of poverty and misery. That is the second hard truth. The third hard truth is that in the coming 10 years or 20 years, coal, oil and gas go still on the increase. So we use more of that stuff. And if you use it more, you get more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. And that may, so this whole story of concentrations, what is the maximum acceptable, we are very concerned about that. And so there is a huge CO2 cluster of problems coming to us. And either you have to live with it, or you have to do things with it, but how to make that work. Now, that is exactly the point. We think this combination of those three hard truths, so the increase of the energy demand, the lack of conventional oil and gas supplies, and the whole CO2 problems, how will governments deal with that? And that we have taken as the lead theme of the scenarios. Jeremy is going to talk about that. Then I come back at the end for the conclusions and look forward to your questions.
So let me add my thanks to those of Jeroen for being here. A good way to understand just how big the transitions will be over the coming decades is to look at the pattern of energy demand. And the patterns are different in our two scenarios, but they have certain similarities, and this is taken from one of the scenarios. And first of all, you can see, of course, how significant the USA has been historically. I mean, currently, the USA accounts for just about a quarter of world energy demand. But by around about 2020, China will actually go beyond the USA in energy demand and continue beyond that. And so you can see there with China the growth of energy demand up to approximately twice the level of the United States and the significance of fossil fuels in that mix. The United States, of course, is one of the most innovative economies in the world. And again, in both scenarios, you see the pattern emerging of what we call the rainbow, the portfolio of different energies that are being applied over time, such that by 2035, for instance, you may have 30% less use of fossil fuels than you do now, despite the growing economy. But you will have about 11% of the use of solar and wind, and by 2050, that could be 20% or more of the total. So these shifting patterns give you a sense of the magnitude of transition that we're talking about in the next decades. Now, as we look at how this may work out, we have introduced our two scenarios. I'll describe them in a little bit more detail in a moment. They are scramble and blueprints. Both of them look out to 2050, because that's the timescales you need to have in mind when you're considering energy investments. Both are very data-driven, so underneath the work that's been done here that I'll be presenting, there's actually a very detailed econometric model covering 70 individual countries, 10 regions to cover the rest of the countries, 8 economic sectors. This is not because we think such models can be crystal balls, but they do force you to be very rigorous in testing the consequences of your assumptions. If you're using a molecule here today, you can't use that same molecule somewhere else tomorrow. So that is the background to that. And they are both scenarios in which the energy component of economic development is met. It's met in different ways and with different types and degrees of stresses within it. But they are not doom and gloom scenarios, but they are scenarios that explore the boundaries of the dynamics we think will shape the energy system. The scramble outlook, if I just was to summarize it, is an outlook which focuses really on national supply and actually embodies quite reactive knee-jerk responses to the various tensions that emerge. In contrast, the blueprint's outlook is a world in which emerging coalitions ultimately accelerate change beyond an initial period of some disorder. The kinds of things you might think about in a scramble world, the signals you might see now, are the signals that hardly a week goes by before you hear of another memorandum of understanding between two different national oil companies, between Beijing and Tehran, or between Pemex and Petrobras. Those kinds of dynamics playing through on a global scale. In the blueprints, the kind of dynamics you might think about are the coalitions of different interests, political and financial, entrepreneurial as well as economic, that came together in California and led to Assembly Bill 32 being signed in 2006, and the influence that has had on other state-level activities and ultimately on federal thinking as well. So this gives you a little bit of sense of the initial dynamics. So talking a little bit more detail now about scramble. I don't know what it's like in your household. We've raised three children and are now raising two grandchildren. And in our household, it's really difficult to deal with one hard truth. Three hard truths is kind of overwhelming. And this is a world in which, you know, people sense that overwhelming complexity. They recognize fear, but some of these fears, for instance, around long-term economic development and around long-term environmental issues, are not clear and present dangers and hence don't lead to early actions. In the face of complexity, people tend to delegate action to institutions to manage complexity on their behalf. And in this outlook, the most prominent institutions are national governments. And national governments have a number of different policy levers that they can pull. In the main, demand-side policy levers are very difficult politically to pull. And hence the focus tends to be on the more easily applied supply-side levers. That can mean promoting an indigenous resource if you have crops or wind or heavy oils that are locally applied. Then those can be encouraged. And similarly, you can sit down government to government and begin to negotiate pipeline access and other routes. Those are the kinds of dynamics which are taking place. And so you see that supply side focus, and you see in the early periods, the periods out, say, towards 2020, a surge in the development of supplies. But these themselves hit their own constraints. On the side of many nations, the most easily accessible local supply is coal, and so you see an explosive growth in coal continuing, with the implications on the environmental side that has. But again, even coal cannot continue growing at an explosive rate indefinitely. You begin to hit logistical constraints. As you know now, China is already importing coal in certain areas because it is easier to import than to expand through the internal infrastructure in the country. Similarly, by the time you're talking about 2020, you have huge logistical developments that are required in terms of railroads and ports to move around the coal.
And at about the same time, you're also seeing the natural plateauing of that easy oil and gas that was being referred to by Jeroen. This isn't because of a lack of molecules, but it's just the natural decline in mature fields, the concentration of fields in various parts of the world, and the fact that investment is required to produce those resources. And the pace of investment will require, will be reflective of the interests of the nations holding the resources, which may not be to grow at the same rate as other parts of the world as well. So by the time you reach 2020, you're beginning to have a squeeze on the energy system, leading to volatility, and finally the turning towards the demand side of the equation. You see draconian measures. Some of you who may be grey-haired like myself can remember the 1970s when there was imposition of speed limits. You can also envisage different parts of the world taking on board the scrapping before their normal economic life of the least energy-efficient plants. At the same time, other areas, complementary energies like the wind and the solar, have grown, but they've grown locally. They haven't reached international scale and international cost competitiveness. The economic conditions encourage those in this period, but it does not mean that those can grow infinitely fast either. It takes time for those to adapt. The one technology that is primed and ready to go is in the biofuels area. The biofuels have already come into the markets now in a large way, so-called first generation, which compete with food currently, but it's also stimulating investment in the so-called second generation areas, which have a much better sustainability profile, and these technologies are ready to be deployed at larger scale by 2020 and begin to be deployed in that way. So if I was just to kind of summarize that kind of scramble outlook in more quantitative terms, as you can see from these charts, the early period is the period of the surge, and you can see reflected there at global scale the impact of the flight to coal. Then the time of squeeze and enforced demand management and enforced acceleration of efficiency measures beyond the historical trend. And then the rebound as finally the new technologies begin to play through. Attention to the climate risks in this scenario come late because they are complex. There's been plenty of rhetoric around them, but action has been postponed until finally there is a political backlash as various events are blamed on a lack of previous action. So you only see the carbon dioxide emission profile from energy beginning to turn towards the end of the period down towards lower levels. Let me take you now quickly through the world of scramble, of blueprints. Blueprints recognizes that there are forces that can combine that accelerate change. Coalitions emerge as new interests are seen. I gave the example from California as a US example. I was in Australia the week before the Australian elections, and there again you saw how the politics had completely changed the position of the Australian government and the candidates for the election at that time around the Australian position on Kyoto. At the same time, I was in both Victoria and New South Wales, and each was claiming credit as a state for having affected the federal thinking. So this is a world, again, in which subnational, state level, but also cross-border coalitions are beginning to influence the national agenda. The national actors still don't go away, but there's a broader range of actors who are influencing them. The C40 group of megacities are sharing best practices around efficiency management and around congestion and energy efficiency already. Critical factor in this world is that meaningful carbon dioxide pricing begins to emerge around 2012 to 2015. This is not global, and it is not driven by altruism. It is driven by this recognition of these emerging interests around energy profitability from sustainable activities, from energy efficiency, and the political dynamics that emerge.
initially, this is not every sector. It is critical number of sectors in a critical number of countries, but it creates the momentum that begins to grow forward. That CO2 pricing stimulates energy efficiency at an earlier stage, and also various key technology developments are brought forward. So you get the earlier coming to scale of the wind and the solar, also the biofuels. A critical technology that is also stimulated is carbon dioxide capture and storage. That is demonstrated in this world as into its technical feasibility completely by 2020, and also the legislative framework is in place for it to be deployed at scale. So it is then deployed at scale over the coming years, such that by 2050, 90% of fossil fuel power stations are equipped with carbon capture and storage in the advanced economies, and about 50% in the developing economies. And overall, that is reducing emissions by about 30% below what they would have been at that time. So they're about a capture and storage of about 10 billion tons per year. Also, through technology policy and the CO2 pricing, you begin to get the new vehicle technologies being advanced. And in this outlook, we see increased electrification of the transport sector emerging from 2020, such that by about 2050, round about 40% of passenger miles are electric driven, either through hybrids, battery electric, plug-in hybrids, or through hydrogen and fuel cell technologies. And that's a technology play that will play through, but is not completely significant for this outlook. You'll see that 60% of passenger miles are still liquid fuel based. These are much more efficient passenger miles than today. It is noteworthy that in the US Energy Independence and Security Act, there was a focus on vehicle efficiency and raising US vehicle efficiency from 25 miles per gallon to 35 miles per gallon, about the same as the European average, which would save around about 40% of the energy use there. That kind of trend continues in the blueprint's outlook. So again, to summarize, we have, first of all, this patchwork of standards beginning to emerge, and then the forces of industry and policymakers step in because they recognize that patchworks impede trade and impede investment, and there needs to be harmonization. So you get this harmonization of a patchwork of standards in the next 5 to 10 years, leading to the CO2 pricing. That encourages reduced energy intensity and reduced carbon intensity, and ultimately you get electrification and carbon capture and storage being important technologies within the mix. So if I just compare these on an energy basis to begin with, the dotted line would be the continuation of historical trends on efficiency and the use of energy. You can see in Scramble, it is not business as usual. It tries to be business as usual as long as possible, but the squeeze then forces it onto a more energy-efficient path. And in Blueprints, you see the additional impact of the early actions on energy efficiency. You can see that renewables are around about 30% of the mix by 2050. And comparing the CO2 emissions, you can see the difference between the late reactions and the early reactions on the greenhouse gas emission profiles. We believe that Blueprints is a route that is as aggressive as seems plausible to ourselves. That profile is still not ideal, but it's certainly much better than in any scramble type of world. And we're working with climate scientists still to try and work through the implications of those profiles over the coming century. That is the impact of carbon capture and storage within that mix. Let me hand on to Jeroen to talk about our thoughts on those outlooks.
Yeah, we come now to the end of the presentation, and if I try to summarize those two scenarios, then the scramble scenario is basically governments and people fighting for their own country and for themselves, and not realizing that that CO2 is a real world problem, or only paying lip service to that. And in the blueprint world, as you can see, is that this is not a poor society, but it is much less CO2 intensive. So whilst especially if you come from my country, but even if you live in Washington, you are not allowed to bet on the weather. It can be good weather and bad weather, and you should have not an opinion about it, because it was to find the right strategy for the firm. But in this case, we have made an exception to that, and we have expressed a preference for which scenario we would prefer in Shell. And that is the blueprint scenario. Now, why is that? First of all, I think as a citizen or as a person just living in this world, you can endlessly discuss what the impact of man-made CO2 is, but it shows clearly in the scenarios that you can still have quite a good economy in the world with much less CO2. So that as a citizen, you prefer that. Secondly, I don't think it is self-serving, but if you think about Shell, the future for a Shell company is, as an international oil company, is that we have to go to the more unconventionals. We have to think how to do this carbon capture. So technology will play an absolute key role in our future. And that technology can be, as entrepreneurs, much better applied in the blueprints world. So we have a more important role to play. And of course, being an enterprise, we like that. So we think it is more a happy marriage between what you think as citizen of the world and what may be good for your company. Now then, what could you do to make this blueprint scenario? Well, what could governments do? And we have made here a list of 5 points. Where basically we say, as Shell company, we think that would be good things. And this is quite interesting, because if you go back then, it is always free enterprise and capitalism and governments, they should stay out. And in fact, in order to make the blueprints world, which I think is better for you and me, and better for our company, the essential point is that in all those 5 points, you need a hell of a lot of cooperation between governments around the world and companies to make it work. And you see that when I go along. We have a cap and trade system in Europe for CO2. There are a lot of teething problems, but we are still enthusiastic about it. We are a bit amazed, or I smile a bit when I promote a cap and trade system here in the US, because they say, well, do we like that and that? May I remind you that the reason that we have a cap and trade system in Europe for CO2, because basically we pinched the concept of your sulfur dioxide trading schemes in the 80s because they were so successful. So basically we borrowed or we got your systems which had proven success about sulfur dioxide, and now we put it to CO2. We think if you would have a CO2 system here in the US, on a kind of similar principles that as in Europe, and later we can get the Middle and the Far East in those kind of schemes as well, that you have then the huge advantage that you have cap and trade, whilst you have not major distortions in competitiveness between the various regions. That's the first point. Quite clearly, you need the governments to make cap and trade system together with industry. Now, the second one is this carbon capture and storage. This is all about level playing field. You can do the technology, we know, but we realize there's not any large-scale project as yet in operation in the world. We would like to do some demonstrations in Shell, not only to improve the technology and to go through the learning curve to get it cheaper, but you have a lot of non-technology questions. When it is stored, who owns it? And when it is stored, and if it leaks, who is doing what? And is that serious? Otherwise, the stuff would have come in the atmosphere anyway. But some people think it is like nuclear waste. So you have to go through those kind of learnings about CCS. Then efficiency in the transport sector. We think that it is inevitable that you can standards on so many miles per gallon. But it is not an easy way to do that. If you say, well, so much percentage of biofuels, but you don't specify what kind of biofuels, or even if you don't think through the miles per gallon, How should you do that? Is it only for Detroit or Japan, or you have better fuels? And then you come to the insights that you better set standards from what we call from well to wheels. So in the end, you like to drive a certain mile for the least amount of CO2, but then you go all the way back to the source and how to get that done. It's more complicated than one thinks. And of course, in order to create large markets for the Detroits or for other companies, it is important that it are similar markets, otherwise you don't get this technology innovation. Incredible targets for wind and solar. Wind and solar, I think, are quite exciting forms of energies, but the key disadvantage today is they are still too expensive for the consumers, solar to make electricity. So they either work in the US, why do you see so many windmills, is because there are certain and important taxation advantages. And as it gets bigger, you have still to think about the backup capacity on the days that there is no wind. So if you look at the total picture, it will be an important form of energy, but to get it off the ground, you have to go through the learning curves to get it cheaper for the consumers. And how can you do that? And then the last one is, of course, buildings and manufacturing. I think you can do still a lot on energy conservation. This is not only about standards, as it says here. As says here on this picture, I was last night again reminded, it was in New York outside, I think it was 6 degrees centigrade, it's pretty cool, but I couldn't get my room anywhere cold. And then you know how you sleep, yeah? Yeah. So I did it according to the Russian method, and finally I found to open a window. But then you get all the noise. Yeah? But it is this incredible how much you still can do with behaviors, how you like to live in buildings in the summer and the winter. And that is pretty low investment. There's still a lot of low fruit on energy conservation to grab. I'd like to stop here. We have then about 25 minutes for questions. Just raise your hand. We will try to give short answers so that many people get an opportunity. Feel not constrained. I'm perfectly relaxed if you like to ask questions outside the scenarios with the three of us and Brian Melnick, our government relations here in Washington. I'm convinced that you may try a question on which we don't know the answer. We'll see. Yeah? Shall I start on the right-hand side, and I work that way? So I first go to the very far. Yeah, you over there. Go ahead. Yeah, and speak loudly so that we can hear.
Yeah. Oh, great. Yeah. Thank you. Can you hear me? Okay. So you gave us a great list of what governments should do. In what way should petroleum companies like yourselves be leading, and what are you doing?
Yeah, if I go, we put it in various boxes. First of all, we started already in the new things that we built, is I think about 8 years ago, we put quite a CO2 penalty on every design we made. And why is that? Because many of our installations, we built that for decades. And if you put a high CO2 penalty on every ton of CO2 you emit, yeah, you will have a more energy efficient units. As far as I know, we were the first one to do that. And in those days, we saw that, we kept that confidential. We saw that as a kind of competitive insight. Secondly, is that we benchmark all the time our refineries, how we drill oil. You have always to compare apples with apples. But then we would like, the basic philosophy is try to be in the top quartile for a refinery, if you compare it with a similar refinery, and so on. So it is all the time benchmarking, try to be a kind of best in class. And if you are not there, there is no panic, but at least then the management has to make plans, how can you move? So that is about the internal operations in new builds and existing operations, what you can do. What we look at well is, of course, the products and services, what we can do there. We are quite advanced in biofuels. We are very large in the first generation biofuels, but we are basically the largest distributor in the world now for biofuels, and that's because we are in Brazil, in the States, and Europe. But that is a dead-end street, because that partly competes with food. So we think it is, and that's why we don't make a lot of efforts about it. So our aim is second generation biofuels, and that is the non-food part, how you can and the non-food part, and it should be sustainable biofuels, and then to have the processes to make transport fuels out of that. And we are all the time moving. And we do that by taking participation in small companies or collaboration, and of course doing our own research. Then we have in Europe a lot of actions to where we help customers to do energy conservation. Last but not least, I think, I have already mentioned the CO2 demonstration projects. We would like to be involved in that because we see that as an important technology coming. Now, may I have forgotten some, but at least you get an impression. I think it is a no-brainer for new entrepreneurialism. Yep. Okay, you at the far-hand side at the wall. Yeah.
Hi, I wondered if you could talk about what you see being the main factors now in oil price volatility, and is $100 oil sustainable over the long term?
Yeah, we don't know. And secondly is that when the oil price was 10 years ago $10, we didn't forecast it would be $100 today. And so even if I have any insight, it's usually we have been wrong. So you have to do the opposite. you have to opposite what we say. We have stopped a bit to make a lot of forecasts. Of course, we look at fundamentals, and we think the fundamentals now are fine. Are no ships waiting in the Middle East, are enough refineries. I didn't see any tailbacks at gasoline stations driving from the airport. There was enough gasoline in the station. So we say, okay, the fundamentals are okay. It has to do with psychology in the price, or psychology about tensions in the world, or lack of spare capacity. Let's not spend too much time about it, but we have to make sure that Shell, whether the oil price is high, low, or volatile, that we are in a better shape than the competition. And if you take that attitude, you don't spend a lot of time for it. So we have basically thought through every situation, and then we take the price as it is. Next question. I go to you in the blue shirt. Yep, over there, by the mic. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, this is a question regarding Iraq. Many believe key to that country's economic success is getting more oil production and earning more oil revenue. I'm just wondering, in talks with Iraqi leaders, how are they progressing in terms of Shell getting in on any deals or contracts to help boost that country's oil production?
We are very much prepared to go back to Iraq. We have done a lot of preparations already over the past years. It needs two things. Our people should have the ability to work there safely. And secondly, you have to know the rules of the game. The rules of the game have to be set by the government. They go, the petroleum law, they are nearly there, but they said more or less the same half a year ago. It all goes very slow. But you have to know the rules of the game, because we have to bring a lot of money to the country. And should we partner up with the government? Should we partner up with other companies? Can we work on our own? And we have made all kinds of different proposals. Having said that, my gut feel is that indeed there is being made some progress. So I hope that towards the end of the year that the petroleum law is there. And then you know the rules of the game, and then the game can start. Yeah, I work to you over there, and then I come to that cluster. Yeah?
I've worked all over the world, sir, for the past 60 years, and bearing in mind your various scenarios, it is very hard to escape the conclusion that political forecasting and economic prognostication have made astrology look respectable. So my question is, how would hostilities between the United States and Iran impact your scenarios?
Yeah, the scenarios you make basically to see supply and demand patterns over the coming 40 years. Yeah, I don't hope so, but you may have always short-term disruptions. But they are in itself, you can't plan for a disruption. I don't think it is the picture how to invest in your research, how to invest in renewables or in conventionals will not be affected by that. And of course, I hope that we can avoid it. Yeah, over there. I go first to you. Yeah, you have to ask for a mic and then the gentleman next to you. Yep.
Hello, Julian Braithwaite from British Embassy. You talked about Shell support for cap and trade. Will Shell support the Warner-Lieberman cap and trade bill, which is before the Senate and is likely to go to a vote later this spring and in the early summer? Thank you.
Not a clue. Brian? Yeah. You have to get the mic. Yeah. Yeah.
We've expressed our desire to work with the committee to fix what we see as some imperfections in that particular piece of legislation. Overall, we do support the approach of cap and trade, but there are some provisions there that we have discomfort with.
Okay. Over to you.
Neil King with the Wall Street Journal. Your statements on hitting a plateau on the oil supply side by 2015 or so have obviously gained a lot of attention. But it's a little confusing exactly what Shell's position is, because at the same time you say there's no shortage of molecules out there. Is it just a matter of investment patterns, and that if it was a perfect world, we could put the right amount of money in the right places, everything would be fine? Or is it that we're facing an actual shortage that we're going to have a trouble breaking beyond?
Eddie? Two experts checking me now. But I think the shorthand is, this is a very good question, the easy oil and easy gas, that is, so that it's relatively at low cost to produce, not too far from the market, so easy to get to the market. That will peak, say, somewhere in the coming 10 years, not next year. And that is the story about, we said, could be 2015. That got a bit of a life on its own. But it is not 30 years out, that we try to say. Whether it is the year 2015 or 2018, I don't know. That is easy oil or easy gas. Now that is, and why is that? Because there is not enough access to it. It is either depleted, think about the US, about your own gas, or so you have what you produced it, or it is somewhere, take Saudi Arabia, there's still a lot of relative easy oil and easy gas. Yeah, certainly easy oil, but they like to spread it over the generations, etc. It is, so what is it not? Mother Nature have put enough oil and gas in the ground. But the problem is Mother Nature, they put that on very difficult places, very deep water in the Arctic, or the oil is tied to the sand or even tied to shale, or you have the gas and you drill a hole in the ground, and easy gas is you drill a hole in the ground, the gas comes out. That was easy gas, and now you drill a hole in the ground, you see the gas, but it doesn't come out. We call it tight gas. Now, and then you have to invest a lot. The investments per unit goes up a lot, per barrel of oil. So, and in order to do that investment, I always say it's not the investments per unit goes up, but the brains per barrel, the brain cells per barrel, they go up as well. Yeah. And that changes will change completely the nature of the industry. It becomes very technology intensive, capital intensive, top expert intensive, and it has longer lead times to get it to the market. And that is causing the problem with this easy oil and gas running out. And that at the same time, I think it is great news for a company like Shell, because we like to be good in technology, we like to be good in project management, and we have hired thousands and thousands of experts mid-career, which we have not done in the past, because we are so sure that there is an opportunity for those unconventionals. So that is the short line of the story. I checked with Jeremy. Yeah, he made all the sums. So I passed the exam.
Excellent, your own indeed. Again, it's really looking at the technology investment and, as Jeroen said, the rationality of behavior for holders of resources.
Yeah. Okay, I'm still at the right. Yeah, you get your chance. Right. Over to you, sir. Yeah.
I'd like to ask you a question that's maybe an elaboration on the previous one. Your presentation is compelling about the need for rules of the game, particularly in that period of 2020 to 2050. But there are abundant challenges in the immediate time frame in terms of access. I am wondering, in particular, what Shell's reflections on access to upstream resources are after experiences such as Sakhalin and others.
Now, I think it itself not new if you go back in the history of the oil industry. In the end, if we only can do the same as national oil companies producing the easy oil, then the value proposition we can make to those governments who have a very strong own agenda will be quite difficult. So for us it is very important that we have unique technologies or operational excellence or track records, or that we can work cheaper, or if we have access to markets, or something which is important in the eyes of those governments who has a very strong own agenda, so that they need us, because then they will probably invite us in most cases to form joint ventures with the national oil companies, as we have done in the past. So it is not always the IOCs, as we call the international oil companies, against the national oil companies, but based on unique things we can do, you can partner up with them. And I expect a lot of that in the future. I go to you, and then I go to the middle block, otherwise we never make it there. Yeah? Okay? Yeah.
Hi. Two questions. The biofuels, you have a fairly optimistic scenario, but it produces CO2, and it also has hydrocarbon inputs, and that's going to be a constraint on it. The other thing is you're relatively conservative on your nuclear forecast. I mean, looking at all the stuff in the media and stuff, both here and in Europe, like England and France, there appears to be a lot of optimism about expanding nuclear, but your forecasts, especially for Europe and America, seem to be very linear. Thanks.
The biofuels, yeah, I think the way we look at second-generation biofuels or next-generation biofuels, it is you have to look at an integrated way, how sustainable are the biofuels, what is their CO2 footprint, because you have to transport the stuff and et cetera, you eat up your own biofuels. What can you do with it? Can you have CCS on biofuels, all kind of things? That is very much part of our thinking. But in the end, you can make second-generation biofuels which don't compete with food, who are more CO2 efficient from well to wheels for transport fuels than alternative products made based on fossil fuels. And certainly a lot better than trying to make transport fuels out of coal, unless you do CCS. Nuclear, in both scenarios, you see quite a role for nuclear. The fact that it goes only relatively slow. Why is that? Because we think the permitting procedures and the time to build, it simply takes a lot of time. But we are in itself, and it may strange for somebody from the oil and gas industry, we think nuclear has a real role to play in the future world. I go to the middle block. Yeah, you, sir. Yeah.
I represent a large science community. And some time ago, I met somebody from Shell who gave me a card that said game changer. And I thought, where's the game-changing scenario here? Where's the one that says that any kind of vehicle doesn't have to have a liquid fuel at all? It can be some kind of electric vehicle in the future. Where's the game-changing that says that the prices of wind and solar and so forth are on a declining scale, whereas you've just pointed out some of the forms of petroleum and so forth are going to be going on an upward scale because of difficulties. So where are the game-changing ideas? Where's that scenario that puts Shell in the forefront where it begins to invest in these game-changing ideas and becomes the leader because it has a patent position, has a lot of discoveries, and creates the next wave of transition completely away from fossil fuels into what will become the next generation of things that we have for energy?
I'll speak a little bit to that because, in fact, that whole game-changing activity was also very much part of the network working into the scenarios. One of the things about the energy system is to recognize the natural time frames in the energy system. If you get a car today and it's a high quality, you know it's still going to be on the road in 20 years' time somewhere in the world. If you build a power plant, it's going to be operating in 40 years' time. So if there are any brand new technologies, they need to be out of the lab now to be significant at scale in the time period that we're talking about. So there are various areas that we're working on there, and Jeroen might want to comment on the algae area in a moment. So there are game-changing technologies, but to see them being applied at scale, our blueprint scenario is really aggressive. It's aggressive on energy efficiency. You can see the fact that 40% of passenger miles are electric by 2050. When we talk about 10 billion tons of carbon dioxide capture and storage. In volumetric terms, that's much bigger than the volumes of the oil industry today. If you speak about solar and wind in these scenarios, and the growth of centralized solar in desert regions, which then powers those regions and enables more export of hydrocarbons, you know, you're talking about levels, 30% of the energy being renewables by 2050 on an energy base that is twice as big as today is a huge growth in 50 years' time. So that's the way it really factors into those areas. And the blueprint's outlook is about as aggressive as we think is feasible.
Oh, sorry. Algae, if they grow with seawater and you can convert them to transport fuels, you avoid the potential sweet water problem. Over to you.
Your first slide, am I on? Your first slide said an era of revolutionary change, but it seemed to me that what you described was two scenarios of evolutionary change. And since most of the governments of the world are talking about a CO2 reduction target globally on the order of 50% by 2050, it would seem to me as chief executive that you would want a planning scenario that describes that future as well. So my question in that regard is, have you done that? And secondly, on biofuels, it seems to me that even the scenarios you describe portray that as a chocolate bar. When is Shell going to move from investing millions in biofuels to billions and show that you're serious?
Just remind me again quickly that first part. Right, okay, let me come to that. As I mentioned earlier, you know, the blueprint's outlook at the scales that we're talking about is about as aggressive as we can see. We're talking about, for instance, rates of efficiency of improvement of vehicle technology worldwide, vehicle efficiency, being twice historical rates. And on top of that, you've got aggressive introduction of electric vehicles. Picking up 2 points alongside that, back in 2000, we introduced two energy scenarios called Spirit of the Coming Age and Dynamics as Usual, which were very technology-driven scenarios. And we looked at changes in that case. And what we have seen is the actual rate of change driven by regulatory activity does not promote those kinds of dramatic changes that have taken place. To reach the kind of halving of current CO2 emissions by 2050 effectively means that by that time, you've got to get into place a zero emissions power sector and a more or less zero emissions transport sector. So starting today, that means every plant today, every power plant has got to be zero emissions. That's what it means. That's not going to happen. So we believe we have try to explore the boundaries of possibility within the scenario context.
Your question, why don't you spend a hell of a lot more money into biofuels? There is no point to spend billions of dollars in a technology which is too expensive for consumers. You simply build a lot of something which doesn't make sense. So the only thing you have to do, you have to go as fast as you can through the learning curves. That has to do with research, demonstration projects and brains. And only after you have a kind of value proposition for the consumers, which is attractive, then you can invest a lot. And that we have learned some hard lessons already there, where we were too early in technologies which people don't like to buy. And, but we are very committed to the renewables, but to get them cheaper. And then we spend the money. Okay, over to you, and then I come back to you. Yeah? We have to hurry up, because 5 minutes more, is that okay, Chairman? Yeah, because I have to go to the left as well. Yeah.
Yes.
We try to be short, yeah?
Why can't why don't you all assume that nuclear power can play a larger role as it relates to electric transport? Why, you know, like, as far as nuclear power is concerned? Because, again, the earlier question is, it hasn't grown much in your scenarios, but if there's such a huge growth in future electrical transport of vehicles, can you answer that?
Okay. You go to the one-line answer.
I'll just go to the one-line answer. Nuclear, very important. However, over the next 20 years, there's such a decommissioning program that you have to have massive new construction just to hold it steady. And then you have to build on top of that. You have to recreate three industries, construction, uranium production, mining, and waste management that have effectively been depleted over the last 20 years. So it just takes time to rebuild the industry and then to have the kind of scope that grows. So we see it growing, but we don't see it able to be the silver bullet.
Thanks. You talked a little bit about carbon credits, and you talked about cap and stow and the like. It, as an international organization, you integrate very well into the company. But as a successful plan for the future, it requires some kind of global monitoring and changing type of system that people collaborate through and to. Do you see that kind of capital investment being made worldwide that can allow these kind of environmental markets to grow?
The CO2, and then worldwide, and that needs basically frameworks, new Kyoto's, Copenhagen's. Good news is that and they only work if the important countries join it. The good news from Bali is that both US, China, India, of all three of them, are still on board. But that's the kind of world that you need. Otherwise, those investments will not be made. I go to you. Yeah?
Charles Horner. 30 years ago, the word synfuels was very much in vogue. And working on the Hill right now, there's a lot of people coming around, and that term is reemerging. And I didn't note it being discussed in one of your scenarios, and I just like your comments on where you see synfuels. Does it have a future, and if so, how much? And
synfuels are oil sands, right?
That's the endowment issue. It's the old legacy
with shale parsing. Yeah, we think it's all part of the unconventionals. And there's still one important thing I like to say here is that I realize that part in the U.S. that people can be quite critical on the oil sands and the CO2 footprint. But realize in the end of the day, if the Canadian government decides to open oil sands and we have better technology than anybody else, we can at least done with oil sands compared to oil sands, we can be the best operator, which we are now. Secondly, is a more difficult argument to make, especially for the general public. And that goes as follows. If you don't do oil sands, what is then the balancing fuel in the world? There must be next best. Because if the oil sands not happens, energy demands don't go suddenly down. That is probably coal or nuclear. I think then about the CO2 footprint. Yeah, over to you.
Jim Bartis from RAND. I noticed that in your preferred blueprint scenario, oil and gas use is considerably higher than in the scramble scenario. Is that being driven by the charge for carbon dioxide?
Jeremy made all this stuff.
So. It's just briefly, it's really part of the dynamics in the market between exporters and importers that begins to drive that. Because as you see more anticipatory behavior from the energy-consuming countries, the higher energy efficiency driven by CO2 pricing, for instance, the more anticipatory behavior leads to exporters seeking to bring forward their production earlier.
First, the gentleman in the sweater.
I noticed in your scenario, one of the policy items you had commended was decoupling in about 2040, the price decoupling. Could you characterize that, what you think might be the way that would take place?
Let me try and give a short answer, but then we'll speak afterwards if it doesn't really satisfy that case. The price decoupling, I think, that you may be referring to is simply that you're beginning to get such a range of alternatives in that rainbow policy mix that you have alternative pricing taking place rather than being just hanging off demand. And so it's the fact that things don't just hang off the demand side, but also alternatives and the cost of those play a role.
Gentleman here, and then I go to the gentleman at the back. The gentleman here at the front.
On the renewable side, to achieve your objective, or the global objective by 2050, you need quite a bit of capital. Those who have capital today are the Arab oil producers, China, and the oil industry. Have you thought about a consortium to invest heavily in the renewable side?
It's back to normal. And if you have good companies and you have, this was a bit of the answer, is you can, if your technologies are cheap enough and the footprint of those renewables are real environmental friendly, and it can compete with alternative energies, we are convinced that you can attract capital. There is nothing new. And that's what we see now as well in the startups of those companies who have really new technologies. In itself, I have to say that because oil and gas, unconventional oil and gas, plays in the scenario such an important role for the coming decades to come, the figures, the investment figures which have to go around are staggering over there. And that's why I still, I don't know what they are going to discuss this afternoon on the Hill here for the Senate hearings. But if I what I always say, yeah, maybe you think that oil makes a lot of profit. But which companies in the world have basically over the years invest every year more or less the full profits again in the future of their companies? Because it is such a capital intensive industry. But I don't think money is in the end the bottleneck. I don't think so. Okay, over you. I promise to you. Yeah.
Keith Crane, the RAND Corporation. I was a little disappointed to see you coming down so hard on cap and trade for countries like India and China and the United States. Carbon dioxide taxes with rebates have some big efficiency advantages, especially because of transaction costs with cap and trade.
We have Stephen Fries, our chief economist. He wrote a whole paper why taxation on carbon is not a good idea and cap and trade better. So give the mic to Stephen and try to be sure it's Stephen. Otherwise, you work it separately, but you get the gist of it.
There are two reasons why we're in favor of cap and trade rather than carbon taxes. First, if you set a cap, you're assured of your path of emissions reduction, provided the cap is credible. With a tax, there is a great deal of uncertainty around the stabilization path. Secondly, we think that cap and trade is easier to implement from a political economy perspective because, the simple answer here is around the politics of taxation, but also you can use, more subtly, you can use the allocation of emission allowances to build political support for a cap and trade system where the rebates that you referred to under a tax system are more complicated to implement primarily through the legislative process.
Offline. I go to the left there and then I go to the last block. Oh, okay. Yep.
Dallas Beanhoff, the Boeing Company. I didn't see space-based solar in your scenarios. Did you look at that, such as what the National Security Space Office report was released in October discussed?
Yeah. I think too far out of space, huh? That is what we. Yeah. Probably later. Yeah. You can't. You will have some surprises that we haven't foreseen. We realize that. Yeah. Over to you. Yeah.
Thank you. With regard to fuel cell technology and other game changers, do you see hydrogen playing a role in the future if distribution and storage can be solved?
Yeah. We started with hydrogen. I worked in the United States in the 90s, and I picked up this idea here. I was quite enthusiastic about it. Jeremy was head of hydrogen for some years. We are still enthusiastic, but it will be less and later. And you have to work a lot of problems. But it is still a quite exciting fuels, but you have still to figure out from what you have to make the hydrogen. So we think there is a future, and it may compete with all kind of alternative forms of transport, but it is not there tomorrow.
Trying to bring this back to why not more, even in the blueprints, a more extreme example. The carbon sequestration, I'd say, is a very strong, very aggressive, the 30%. But, you know, if I look at Scramble and blueprints, Scramble actually has more renewable power in 2050. We've got companies such as Google putting $1 billion in renewable energy, less than coal. I don't see that game-changing possibility being played fairly whether there's a lot of us use quad rather than two scenarios, and the true game changers don't seem to be played here.
Yes, indeed. One of the reasons why you see less renewables ultimately in blueprints is that you see less energy being used. So the aggressiveness on the energy efficiency has had that major impact, and then the rest plays through the economics. It's still a very huge amount, and particularly given the high electrification of the blueprint scenario.
Now we take two questions more, and then I stop. We take those two. Is that okay? Unless it makes you very angry, then you come up to us. You first, and then you. Yep.
Ariel Cohen, the Heritage Foundation. Two quick questions. One on multiple fuel vehicles. Do you believe this changes anything if you get a vehicle that can run on a variety of combustible fuels? And second, tax policy, how you view, for example, the huge difference between Europe, where gas is between $9 and $11 a gallon, and the U.S. now with $3.50 or whatever.
I was amazed. We spent a lot of time on the second question in New York and didn't come up in Washington, but okay. I'm a bit amazed, maybe because I'm from Europe and I look after all those E85 cars, because that if you see the amount of biofuels that is likely to be blended into the gasoline pool, you simply can blend it into the gasoline pool and then it goes up for via 5% to 10% of whatever. That it doesn't need a new infrastructure, doesn't need really new engines. It is cheaper for the consumer because there is no reason to pay for a more expensive car in order to pay part of capital charge of the more expensive infrastructure. But if you read the papers, some people are very enthusiastic about all those dual fuel schemes. I'm a bit puzzled about that because from a macroeconomic point of view, it is, I don't think, a very good solution, and you have enough space simply to blend it in the pool. And that is from a CO2 point of view, of course, the same. Some people have problems with that, but that is, I think, quite obvious. Your second question is that we have the price of gasoline was at the Shell station nearby here, I think $3.34 was the lowest I saw per gallon. If you compare that to Europe, we live, depending on how weak the dollar is, on a kind of $7 or $8 per gallon at this moment. And the average fuel efficiency of a car is 40% better than the US. And then I add to that, that the Europeans are not less happy than Americans because they have to pay more for their gasoline. That is simply not true. Yeah? And so. You can't deny that having a lot of duties or taxation or gasoline, that it impacts the behaviors, what kind of car you drive. Not necessarily probably the miles that you drive. Then you get the whole debate, if you would do that in the States, how is that taxation used? How is it the whole debate because you are less in public transport, but you have to start somewhere, etc. I think these are, in the end, real political choices. But the political choices, they were there 10 years ago, but the new element to it is, of course, that you could then still drive with less CO2 by doing that. Okay, you the last question, and then we work your questions. We are still around here.
Yeah, Maria Pineda, UCLA. I wanted to ask you, what is your opinion about the development of LNGs, especially with the difficulties siting in the United States and elsewhere, and also on the future possibility of doing auctions at sea and other issues that can scramble even more the market in this respect?
I beg your pardon, but I missed the first part, your first question. The technologies for what?
LNG, liquefied natural gas. LNG.
No, you take the question if you got it. Oh, the future for LNG. Oh, I think the United States and Canada, they have quite a decline rate in their own gas. Now, that is the easy gas. Then you have a lot of difficult gas, the Pine Dales, as we call that. But over time, you will be quite, if you take decades ahead, you have to import more gas or to go to other forms of energy. LNG, liquefied natural gas from other parts of the world, will be a very important fuel. And that is, you have to build those projects. We expect that that industry continues to grow about 10% of volume per year, so doubling every 7 years. That is quite something. And you see, you get a lot of regas terminals at the East Coast and the West Coast, and people have to, and of course, you get not in my backyard problems because you need those terminals. I saw that yesterday for New York, if you read the New York Times. Yeah? But it will come. And I think it is a very good development because in your total energy mix for this country, I think it is a very logical solution. Now, that is the first part. And then the second part? Oh, okay. Is that fine? Okay. Shall we stop here? Thank you very much for your questions. Sorry to cut you off.
Let me just make two quick announcements. We will post the slides on our website. I'd like to thank Jeremy and Jeroen for coming here and also for your moderating skills. This made the morning extremely easy. So thank you very much.